Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries Season 2. It's great to be back. I'm Holly Rubenstein. I'm a travel journalist and editor, and here each week I'll be speaking to a very special guest about their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. If you're new to the podcast, welcome. Thank you for tuning in. And don't forget, there's all of season one to catch up on. Just hit subscribe and take a look through the feed. I can assure you it's wanderlust guaranteed. I hope you all had a lovely Christmas. God, that feels like a while ago. And a very happy new year. Since we last spoke, I've been busy recording episodes with some brilliant guests for this season that I can't wait to share with you. And I also got married in December, so it's been a really exciting and busy time. Thank you so much to those of you who've been in touch. I've loved hearing from you. Some of you have asked me about my own travels, and as I'm going to be traveling a lot more during this season for work, I'll keep you posted on where I'm heading. Last week, I visited one of the most hotly tipped new openings in the UK, the Newt in Somerset, which I'm sure a lot of you have already read about, but I'll fill you in on what I thought later on in the show. And another place that I loved, I stayed after my wedding actually at what I guess I would definitely describe as one of my hidden gems now. It's called Beaver Brook. It's a country house hotel just outside of London in the Surrey Hills. It's beautiful, so historic. It was owned by Lord Beaver Brook, and people like Winston Churchill and Elizabeth Taylor used to go there for what I can only imagine were very glamorous holidays. And its restaurant serves some of the best Japanese food I've ever eaten. And speaking of delicious food, it's time to introduce today's guest. He's graced our screens and lined our bookshelves for over 25 years, cooking up cuisine from all over the world. Fish is his great love, served in his restaurant empire from Padstow, Cornwall to Sydney, Australia. It is, of course, Rick Stein. Along with his travel diaries, we talk about the very surprising career path he originally pursued that had nothing to do with food and might make you laugh. How the loss of his father led him on a real voyage of self-discovery around the world. And he reveals which destinations he's tipping for this year's culinary hit list. All that and more coming up. Well, I am here with culinary royalty, Rick Stein. Welcome to the Travel Diaries.
Thank you very much for inviting me, actually, because I love talking about my travels.
I saw that you spend about 6 months of, is it 6 months of every year travelling?
Well, I suppose so, if you add up. I mean, I've got two restaurants in Australia, so I go there for about, I go there three times a year. Well, that takes up, you know, getting on for 2 months. The other 4 months, either holidays or filming. So, yeah, I suppose it would be about right. Yeah.
So we've got a lot of travel to cover. But let's start right at the beginning with chapter one of your travel diaries, and that is your earliest childhood travel memory.
Well, it's rather an unfortunate one, really. But when I was very little, my parents used to take me to the Scilly Isles quite often. So I've got really fond memories of the Scilly Isles and first overseas trip I ever did, if you like.
And the Scilly Isles are off the coast.
Just off the coast of Cornwall, yeah.
Not easy to get to.
Well, not easy. And in those days, there was a plane. Because I can remember the second trip going on the plane. But the first trip was on the Solonian, which is the little boat that plies between Penzance and St. Mary's in the Isles of Scilly. And because actually quite a lot of the way is fairly shallow, it's got a very, very flat bottom. And I was appallingly seasick. I can remember, you probably can, anybody can, aged about six. And the thing that I remember most was, for some reason, I looked into the engine room and there was this massive engine, smell of sort of diesel and smoke, and feeling terribly nauseous.
Feel the nausea rising, to even describe it. Did you love the Scilly Isles, though, once you made it there?
Yes, I did. I mean, it's just a magic part of the country, really. And I think anybody that goes there feels the same way because, you know, Cornwall's not part of the UK and the Scilly Isles is not part of Cornwall, really. So you're feeling really somewhere very different. And I think islands generally have that sort of effect on people. So I love it. Yeah, I haven't been back there for a while, but I'd love to go back.
So you grew up in two of the most beautiful parts of England. First, the Cotswolds in Oxfordshire, and then, of course, Cornwall.
Yes.
So for our international listeners who might not be familiar with Cornwall, can you bring the English Riviera to life?
Well, I suppose it's the thing about Cornwall is it's on the peninsula jutting out into the Atlantic Ocean, and Land's End, of course, is at the end of it. So it's sort of three parts surrounded by water, and therefore, and quite a narrow peninsula, therefore the sea and the seafaring and fishing have an immense influence on it. There's a sort of Celtic tradition in all those three parts of the UK and Ireland. And there's sort of slightly sort of mystical feel about it. I remember years ago going to a druid ceremony in Liskeard in Cornwall and thinking this is quite something. Everybody dressed up in pale blue, looked like night dresses. There is a sort of not of this world of the UK quality about Cornwall. And I think that's what really draws people there, apart from the fact of the lovely beaches, fantastic fish, great produce. So it's a bit special in everybody's heart, I think, that knows that. And it's a bit like going to France. It's part of one's childhood that most of us went on holiday to Cornwall, as indeed I did in the first place.
And, of course, now the gorgeous village of Padstow has been nicknamed Padstow because of your restaurant empire there. I remember making my own pilgrimage down there with my mum as a teenager and trying your famous fish and chips and looking out at the harbour. It's a really special place, isn't it? For people who want to go there and try some of your signature food, there's a kind of spectrum of different restaurants that they can go to, aren't there?
Well, that's right. The reason for that is that from the early days, we just had the one restaurant, which was the seafood restaurant. But I felt that if we wanted to attract people to come to Padstow and stay, we would need to have different restaurants at different price ranges. So we first opened, this is myself and my ex-wife Jill, we first opened a bistro which was designed to be not seafood orientated, more meat orientated, although these days it's sort of almost, I don't know, 70% seafood. Then we opened a cafe for the same reason, that was sort of cheaper and more informal. And then we opened the fish and chip shop, which was based on my travels mainly in North Yorkshire, because I find the fish and chips in North Yorkshire exceptional, and in Scotland, on the east coast of Scotland as well. And finally, we've opened a little seafood bar, which is sort of actually my homage to similar places in France. Just a place that sells mostly cold platter de fruits de mer, little platters of prawns, cold lobsters, crab and mayonnaise, that sort of thing.
So it's just a culinary adventure, basically, when you go down there.
Well, that's right. And also now, which is actually very rewarding for us all, there's like two very famous chefs with restaurants in and around Padstow. First, Paul Ainsworth, number 6, and second, Nathan Outlaw at Port Isaac. So it's sort of like a bit of a gastronomic destination, I think, now.
Absolutely. But is it fair to say that food and being a chef wasn't necessarily the first port of call, that you didn't have a burning desire to be a chef immediately?
No, not really. I mean, I opened a nightclub in Padstow originally with a friend of mine. And, it was an existing nightclub, which in itself is quite weird, because Padstow's, you know, a fishing, people say village, but actually it is a town.
So were you a bit of a party animal then?
Well, I had discos. I had like mobile discos, which I had two.
Yeah.
One which I looked after and one which my then wife Jill looked after. So we used to do like local village halls and parties and pubs and things.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking for somewhere to sort of have a permanent sort of residence for the disco. Bought this club, but of course I had no idea about licensing laws. It was very, very tricky to keep a place like that running within the law. And eventually, really, because neither myself or Johnny, my friend, were sort of like well-versed in running nightclubs, it had late hours and drinking late at night, we got like closed down. And I opened the restaurant as a way of sort of keeping going in the building, really, and sort of never looked back.
So do we have the police to thank for your culinary?
Well, Holly, that's really interesting you should say that, because in fact, about, I don't know, 6-8 years after I opened the restaurant, I got invited by the inspector who had closed down the club round to tea. And he just said... in a way, we were sad to have to close you down, but you were so naive and so silly. He said, I can only say that I'm very pleased for you, what you've done with the place.
Yeah, absolutely. So moving on to chapter two then, which is the first place that you fell in love with.
Well, I suppose the first place I fell in love with was France, really. I mean, I was lucky in that my parents travelled a great deal, not with the children as much as they did with themselves. We were always a bit sort of miffed when we got postcards from Italy or San Francisco or Cape Town. But we did go on family holidays, first to France and then to Spain and then in Italy. So I suppose it was, for me, French food was a sort of early awakening as to the wonders of sort of foreign cuisine. And I remember about 14 going to on an exchange with myself and my sister Henrietta to northern France near Cambrai to some friends of my father's who had it was a sugar beet farm that also grew petit pois and haricot vert. And they were really well off, these farmers. They had a chateau, and we stayed in the chateau. And we were served on by a butler. We were given breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day. And sometimes there was just me and my sister on our own with this butler who served us with white gloves. And I always remember the fantastic food. I mean, the steaks, like the sort of, we served half a whole fillet steak with a delicious sort of red wine sauce, fantastic pommes frites, particularly the petit pois, which the family grew, but which we would have from a jar, of course. And for me, as a 14-year-old, I couldn't believe that I was served local cider, fizzy cider, by the butler with his white gloved hand. And to be served like that as 14 was very, very grown up, I must say.
Yeah. And so was that your first kind of dipping your toe into your love of food?
Well, it was really. I mean, I'd been on other trips. I do remember an early trip to Spain when I was about 8 or 9, I suppose, to the Cantabria. We went on a family holiday to a place called Laredo on the coast. And I remember, I can't remember why, but having a dish of squid cooked in its own ink. And I think I was probably trying to show off to my parents by saying, yes, this is lovely. Very fond memories.
And of course, we're here to talk about your wonderful book, Secret France, which I have loved leafing through. I love that there's both recipes and your writing, because, of course, you are also a very talented writer. I mean,
well, thank you, Holly. I didn't, you know, appreciate that.
Well, you studied English at Oxford. I'm sure that was a good background.
Probably, yeah.
And I have really enjoyed reading it. So where would your very favourite place in France be?
I would have a very big sort of trying to influence people to go to the Auvergne, right? It's one of those parts of France which isn't so visited by British people.
Where in France is that?
It's right in the Massif Central.
Right.
Not only the Auvergne, but I would urge people to go to the city of Clermont-Ferrand, which is the capital city of that area, simply because I think it's where the Michelin Tire Company has its big tar factories, but the city itself is a university city. It's got a most beautiful cathedral. It's got its own sort of culture. And it's not very well visited by tourists. And I can't quite understand why, because I loved it. But then you've got the surrounding countryside, which is the Auvergne, which is really steep hills, almost verging into mountains, but not quite. And actually it's a sort of place that time forgot. So a lot of the local restaurants in the Auvergne are very, very well run and specialise in only local food.
So it's a place to go for an authentic French experience.
I would say absolutely, yeah. Mm. And so that for me, I mean, there's obviously wonderful other parts that I visited, the Jura particularly, which I love, and Roussillon right down at Calore and Perpignan, where we've got this fantastic Catalonian food. But I think the Auvergne was the one that the memory I bring back, the Auvergne in Clermont-Ferrand.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb. So chapter three, Rick, is the place where you learnt the most about yourself. Where would that be?
Well, it would be Australia, really. I was sort of lucky or unlucky enough to go there on a sort of gap year. And I mean, this was like in the 60s. Mm-hmm. It was a gap year and a half. And I was sort of fresh out of rather a sort of secure and family-based background. But my father sadly died around that time. And I'd sort of left to go to Australia as a way of sort of running away from problems at home.
Yeah.
And it was,
you couldn't
just
have gone much further.
You could not. But it was a rite of passage for me. And I mm-hmm. was a rather sheltered, not particularly, I thought, adventurous boy. And I came out a lot more adventurous and a lot more aware of what goes on in the world, because I not only went there, I then went on to New Zealand and then Mexico and the States and Canada and then back through Europe. So I came back a different person, really. But it's Australia that I owe my... That was the most really, really formative time. I was like 19, 20.
Oh,
and I spent about 4 months out in the outback near Alice Springs working on a railway for a railway gang, which is basically people that looked after the track.
Wow, very remote.
It was very, very remote. And, you know, I've never forgotten the landscape there. And every time I sort of see someone, funnily, in a recent program, I went to Iceland. And it sort of reminded me, weirdly, of the centre of Australia, not obviously because of the temperature, but because of the enormity of nature when you're in a place where there's nobody.
Mm.
And the effect it has on you as a human being. And I know I've spoken to so many people that have been to Iceland since then and said the same thing.
That yes.
It's a sort of must-go sort of place.
The big skies.
The big skies.
Yeah.
This sense of sort of, gosh, we are so meaningless, really.
Mm, amongst all of that.
Yes.
So 1920, that is such a difficult age for somebody to go, for anyone to go through a loss like that. Would you say then that your travel in Australia was therapeutic for you?
Yes, it certainly was. I mean, and I've always since then retained a love of Australia, which continues to this day. I just love the people there. I love the country and I love their sort of can-do attitude.
And does travel still serve the same purpose for you now, would you say?
I mean, it certainly does. And I mean, you know, I suppose I go to Australia. I reckon I've been well over 100 times to Australia now. And whenever I get on the plane, right?
How do you cope with that flight as a
Well,
aside?
I quite like the flight, actually. I mean, because generally I tend to go with BA only because they've all been to the restaurant in Padstow. So there's always one of the stewards saying, I was there at your place last week. And it's sort of, I don't know, it just feels more sort of natural to be on this sort of massive journey. And the flight itself I really love because I, you know, I actually tend to listen to the radio or listen to music rather than watch films. I just relax. The jet lag is another matter.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. So chapter four then is your all-time favourite destination, my favourite chapter.
It's such a difficult one because I've been, you know, I mean, I'm lucky I've been to so many places. And a lot of them I've been to with, you know, filming. And so what you tend to do, because it makes for good filming, is fall in love with some place. Because if you were saying, well, I'm here, but I don't really like it, what's the point of being there?
Yeah.
I think probably for various reasons, I think India would be probably my favourite. I mean, and I would just say Rajasthan, of all the places I've been there, just simply because it's so vast, it's so dry, it's almost like being in the sort of Wild West in a funny sort of way. And it's just this sense of openness there, and fantastic food, of course, and brilliant sort of palaces that you end up staying in. I remember, I can't remember where it was now, but I remember being in this sort of fantastic palatial bedroom with sort of stained glass everywhere and being told, oh, well, this is where whoever the prince was that lived the palace, where he used to meet with his concubines.
Oh, my God.
So you don't get that sort of anywhere
no.
else. So,
and you spent a great deal of time in India.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, I think it's one of those places that you know, love or hate, because, I mean, you know, the poverty and all that and the But I just find the sort of exoticness of it and the friendliness of the people. It's very, very important that.
And what about the cuisine? I mean, obviously it's so varied. So where is your favourite food in India?
Well, I suppose generally the cooking of Northern India is my favourite. But one has to bear in mind there's an awful lot of butter and yoghurt in that sort of cooking.
You can't eat it every day.
You can't eat it every day. But I suppose, I mean, thinking of particular favourites, Lucknow, I really like the food. I really like the sort of royal food or the Mughal food of Lucknow. The only problem I have with Lucknow is we were filming there. And, you know, I obviously when I'm filming, everything looks wonderful on that. But you are working, right? You are filming. And really, if there's one place I'd really love to go back, it's Lucknow on holiday and really take in all those things that I had to sort of talk about, but then take them with the sort of, there's something about being on holiday that's totally different.
Yeah. When you're filming, you're just scratching the surface, really, not getting to fully immerse yourself in it.
You don't have time because you've got
of course,
to, you know, you've got to
schedule.
Keep talking to people and you've got to keep moving.
So what's Lucknow like? Because I don't know much about it.
Well, I mean, it's a sort of it's one of the centres of Mughal cooking. So it's like the Mughals, you know, came up down from Persia with this fantastically rich meat driven food. At one stage, one of the sort of princes in Lucknow were feeding his chickens saffron, or was it gold leaf? I'm not sure, one or the other, in the hope that the flesh would turn out either coloured gold or flavoured, scented with saffron. Wow. So it's just that sort of, I suppose it's the same as like in Istanbul, a sort of like royal cooking. It's so wonderfully over the top.
Yeah.
And at Lucknow is one of the homes of biryani, which I think's, it's so hard to cook a perfect biryani.
Mm.
But they do it in Lucknow.
Mm, that's the place to go for it.
Yeah.
How about a favourite city?
Well, I suppose I'd have to say Sydney, really.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm only saying I'd have to say it because I go there so often.
What is it about Sydney that you love?
The thing about Sydney, unusually, and there's a few other cities around the world, is it's on an ocean. It's not on a river, it's on the ocean.
Mm.
And the other thing is that there's a lot of really lovely ocean beaches in Sydney. Plus, the main town is in a big estuary. So even if you're not on a surfing beach, you've got these fantastic beaches in the sort of like Sydney water area. So that there's nowhere really in Sydney, unless you go out right deep out west, where you're not close to the sea and where you can just go and go for a swim, which is one of my great delights.
Yeah.
Plus, the climate isn't too bad. And the food is fantastic.
Yeah.
And I've witnessed that because I've been going to Sydney, since I was 19. These days, the standard of cooking is so high. But it's funny, even in the 80s, I was going there, and I sort of almost remember the time when suddenly chefs, young people started cooking. Because at one stage in the early 80s, I remember talking to a Frenchman who'd had a restaurant in Paris, in Avalon in northern Sydney, on the beach. And he was running a general store, like a post office with, you know, and I said, got talking to him, and I said, well, why don't you carry on opening a restaurant? You do so well here. And he said, I can't get anybody to work in restaurants. Everybody really? Wants to be on the beach. And this was like 1984.
Right.
By 1988, everything was different, and people really wanted to be cooks, to be waiters. And now it's a very sophisticated
place. A real culinary destination.
Yeah, it is.
Speaking of which, I mean, I'm a foodie traveller, I'd say. I love food. And I'm always trying to keep my ear to the ground for where's the kind of next hot place when it comes to cuisine, somewhere that's a bit under the radar. Do you have any recommendations?
The one place I have and I would like to go is Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia, because yeah. I've heard great things about Tbilisi, and I will go there in the next 2 or 3 years. I think it's just because of it's an incredibly fertile part of the world. There's a wine sort of originated, or the wines that we know in Georgia, and I think there's a great sort of culture and a great sort of pride about what they're doing there. I can't add any more there than that because I haven't been there. But every time I meet people who've been there, they say, you've got to go.
Mm, definitely feels like a hot destination for this year.
Yes.
We just need a few more direct flights from the UK.
Well, I know. I mean, I think it's about, 5 hours, 6 hours? But there's only like a couple
of
airlines.
One airline, yeah.
Yeah.
What's the food like there? Do you know?
Well, I don't, but I imagine it's sort of Mediterranean because it's the same climate. So I imagine there's quite a lot of olive oil cooking, but probably mixed with the sort of same sort of food as you get in the Ukraine. I don't know.
Mm. As a tourist, are you driven by food in terms of deciding where you would go?
Totally driven by food.
Really?
I mean, it's the first... and most important part of any trip, planning any trip. I won't go anywhere where I don't think the food's any good because I just get a bit cast down, you know. I mean, it's food first and then sort of cultural stuff second.
Yeah.
But I need both, to be honest. And that's why I think the programs we did called Long Weekends were so successful because they were driven by food. But I needed some history to throw in and some atmosphere. And that's why somewhere like Bologna, surprisingly, was one of the most popular of my destinations because it's not actually a city, although it's probably, in Italian terms, the most famous city in the whole country for food. But a lot of British people didn't know that. But for me, I mean, the food was fabulous, incredibly rich, tons and tons of parmesan, tons of prosciutto, everything sort of wrapped in masses of prosciutto and parmesan inside. Yeah.
Is it where spaghetti bolognese comes from?
Of course, and it's also the home of ragu bolognese, which they always do with tagliatelle, not with spaghetti.
Mm.
Plus, they have this fantastic wine called Sangiovese, which is quite... It's not particularly full-bodied, but and it's quite acidic, but it really works with their rich cooking.
I've heard that Bologna is a fantastic city, and I loved watching it on your long weekend series. So many hidden gems, which actually leads us on to chapter five, which is your favourite hidden gem. Could you tell us about a destination we might not know so much about?
It's my sort of job to sort of unveil hidden gems, really. And I suppose, in a sense... That's what Secret France is all about. As I mentioned, I think the Auvergne and Clermont-Ferrand would be one of them. But there were a lot of other sort of smaller places that we went to. You know, Jura, for example. Jura, people don't go there.
Where's Jura?
It's just very close to Burgundy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's sort of between Burgundy and the Alps.
Right.
So you've got Jura itself, which is quite hilly, really hilly. Limestone country, same as Burgundy. But then you got Eau Jura, which is like in the foothills of the Alps. So you've got like similar food to Burgundy at one stage, and then you're getting into alpine cooking further as you go up. But the thing that I love about Jura is they have this sort of very idiosyncratic wine made from a white grape called the Sauvignon. And they make it rather in the same way as the Spanish make sherry. In other words, they oxidize it to a certain extent. So most people just think that it's gone off.
Yeah.
But it's one of those wines that once you've got a taste for it, you really love. And also, really, it's really good for cooking with.
Chapter six, in contrast, then, is the place that you would never go back to.
Well, I've just thought and thought about this, and, you know, it's almost disrespectful to say I'd never go back to a place because you never know. I mean, I used to think that the seafood cooking in Corsica was pretty ordinary, but the fact is that the mountain cooking in Corsica is fabulous, the ingredients in Corsica. So I'm sort of thinking, in a way, the one place I wouldn't go back to is somewhere that I really liked in the series, right? There's one place, actually in Jura again. There's a bar we went to, which is a bit like one of those Irish bars that when we were, used to go to Ireland a lot in the 80s with my young kids and my friends. You know, one of those bars where you've got like the bar on one side and the grocers in the bar, but on the other side.
Yeah.
Well, it was like that. And there was this woman just running it, and it was like full of bric-a-brac, like sort of, sort of pirates, statues of pirates and sort of old mandolins and jugs and dust everywhere. And it wasn't put on. It was just like, this is my bar. And I thought, well, I wouldn't go back there because in a way we filmed there, but I haven't told anybody where it is. And I was sort of thinking, well, if I went back there and everybody had found it, I'd be so disappointed because that's one of the sort of spin-offs of... Unfortunate spin-offs of doing travel food programs. I've sort of nailed it in the series where I quote from the Hotel California album. One of the tracks says, you call someplace paradise and kiss it goodbye. And that's what I've spent all my life doing. Oh, you must come here. It's great.
Yeah.
So everybody goes there.
Yeah.
So that's the one place.
So this is your hidden gem, actually, but it's also
both.
Another place.
It's both.
So chapter seven, then, is your next big adventure. What destination do you have your eye on?
I'm actually going to Trieste in northern Italy because it's sort of, if I did another long weekend, it's where I go. It's, again, a bit like Tbilisi. I've read about it, but I think it's an Italian city, but I think it's more like Vienna on Sea. But I haven't been there. I know the sort of buildings are very sort of like empire-type buildings like Vienna. But I imagine the food would be a cross between Viennese, Austrian and Italian. And everybody that goes there absolutely loves it. Also, what's really fascinating for me is, of course, one of my great literary heroes, James Joyce, lived there for a long time. So to follow the sort of James Joyce trail, not through Dublin, but through Trieste.
Sounds
it's not
wonderful.
A big trip, but it's like, I'm really, really looking forward to it.
And is that a holiday?
Yeah, I'm going with my wife, Sass, and, you know, it's really good going with her because, yeah, just suppose we ended up filming there, that she's really good at sort of finding the little quirky details that make sort of programs when you're in a city like that come alive.
Wonderful. Well, I can't believe we're on to chapter 8, the last chapter of your travel diaries, and that is what's at the top of your bucket list.
Well, I've got a massive bucket list, actually. So you want the top one. I'm just going to have a look.
Do you have a list on your phone?
Yeah, I do, because it's just that my...
so do I, actually. What,
you do?
Yeah. So, I tick them off if I ever get to them, yeah.
Here we are, bucket. I think probably it's Argentina and Buenos Aires, because I've never been to South America anywhere. So it's probably, I don't know if it's the best place to go in South America, because I think it's, from what I can gather, it's like the most European city probably in the whole of the Americas. So it's not sort of typical, but I just hear it's so wonderful. The food, I'm sure, is going to be great, but it's slightly run down, I think. So not nearly as bad as somewhere like Havana, but I think there'd be a sort of wonderful... slight decrepitude, which I love. I mean, one of my other favourite cities in the world is Palermo, for the same reason. It's sort of slightly scruffy, but there's a sort of like immense sort of atmosphere about it. So that and the tango, I just think it'd be the most interesting place to go. And of course, I suppose it's the most European. I don't know about Mexico City, which I love too, but I think the sort of the combination of Spanish and Italian and probably British in Buenos Aires would make it really, really special.
Mm. I'm sensing Rick Stein's Argentina needs to be added to the to next year.
You
Fantastic.
Never know.
Oh, brilliant. Well, thank you so much,
That's
Rick.
Great, Holly.
Those are your travel diaries. Thank you so much.
That's a pleasure.
Oh, that was the utterly delightful international treasure, Rick Stein. As well as being such a pleasure to chat to, this had to be one of my favourite interviews, as I was lucky enough to eat a fish pie that Rick had cooked from his new book, Secret France, after the interview was over. He offered it to me for my lunch, and I'm not exaggerating when I say it was one of the most delicious things I've ever eaten. It had these caramelized apple slices over the top, which I'd never thought would go with fish, but it really, really does. I'm just thinking about it now. That was very exciting. Rick's book, Secret France, is out now, and the accompanying TV series is on BBC iPlayer. If you've enjoyed this episode, leaving a review or a rating really helps others to discover the podcast. And to find out who's on next week's show, come and find me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubinstein, and I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you again next Tuesday. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb super host. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom, and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.